Session number 11105, Colonel M. McBain, Reel 4.
Colonel N. McBain, Reel 4. How did you spend your leisure time at the College of Colonel?
There wasn't a lot of leisure time, and it was, thinking again with hindsight, it was very restrictive. For example, we were only allowed out on certain occasions, and you had to book out and then book back in again, and that was always a slightly, you got used to it eventually, but you had to clock in, back in with an officer, a cadet, under officer of some sort, in one of the anterooms, in one of the company anterooms, and you had to walk in and sort of report your name and company and so on, and you were ticked off in a book. And it really was like being back at prep school almost. We were not allowed into any pubs in Camberley. Camberley obviously was just on the doorstep. We weren't allowed into pubs in Camberley, so you had to, if you wanted a drink, but of course we didn't, or not many did. A, you didn't have very much money, and B, just didn't have the inclination. In most of my circle, we used to go whenever we could. There was a cafe on the London Road called The Wayside, sticks in my mind, where you could get a very good fry-up of bacon, eggs, chips, and fried bread and so on, for not very much. A funny old place run by a very elderly old fellow and his presumably daughter. One of the memorable things was this stuffed full of old Country Life magazines. So we used to go there. In your senior term, you were allowed to have a car or a motorbike if you were an under officer, I think. But otherwise, no. If you went out, you had to wear a hat or a cap. It was all very restrictive. Occasional weekends, but not very many. And then, like school, you had Christmas holidays and summer holidays. The three terms, roughly, were the autumn and then into the summer. And then there were three terms a year. How were they divided? Autumn, and then presumably up to Easter or thereabouts, and then through to the summer. There were big social events, of course, in the academy, particularly the passing out. There was a summer ball and a winter ball. They were the two passing out balls, which were great social events. You know, they were always very sought after things to go to. Obviously, if you were involved passing out, you went to your own passing out ball.
And did you invite your girlfriend or what?
Girlfriends to the dances, and you would go out and have an enormous great dinner and and so on in a local hotel. Who were quite used to this, and then back into the academy for the dance, which would go on all through the night with various degrees of hilarity. But they were great social occasions, which was nice, particularly if you were passing out and leaving the place. Apart from that, though, there wasn't a lot of social activity. there were dinner nights in the officers in the mess, in the cadets mess, and there were guest nights. But of course, they really were duty rather than pleasure.
This brings in the question of money. What were you paid as a
private? We were paid as private soldiers. I mean, officially in the army, so far as the manual of military law was concerned, we were private soldiers, and we retained our army number, and so we were paid as soldiers. But we were paid. There was a Sandhurst Bank, which in fact was the unit pay office, but it was a bank, and it was run as a bank by the pay corps, and you had an academy checkbook, and that was how you ran your finances. And most people, not everyone obviously, but most people from memory were purely dependent on their army pay. Obviously, a number of people had their own money, but most people, I think, were on their army pay, which wasn't very much, and I honestly can't remember. It was something silly like 30 shillings a week.
Did you have to meet your mess bills in the cadet mess?
Yes. There were certain mess expenses, but not very many. Mainly it was cash. There was a thing called the Junior Ranks Club, which was obviously the equivalent of the junior common room in New York City. And that was just like a junior common room in a university, except now I'm trying to think whether there was alcohol. I don't think there was alcohol on sale in the JRC. The only alcohol you got was very limited in the officer's mess. No, it was normally just beer, and very small quantities of that. That I think you paid for through a mess bill of some sort. But I can genuinely say I think that you really didn't worry about money too much. You didn't have very much of it. Nobody did, but you didn't have much to spend it on anyway. Because you weren't out, it wasn't as if you were going into Camberley boozing every night. You could go to the cinema in Camberley, but again, time, you didn't have an awful lot of time. By the time you had dinner and cleaned your kit for the next morning, obviously you got more experience at all, you got more practiced at all this as time went on. So by the time you were in your senior term, it really didn't take very long. And in your senior term, you did have more freedom. Not a lot, but you did have more freedom. And then came the great day when you marched up the steps and away.
Before we get to that, the relationships within the student body itself, were there any form of initiation ceremonies to go through or any?
No, there was none of that. There was inter-company rivalry. And within companies, no, there was nothing within companies, but certainly there was inter-company rivalry, but nothing dramatic at all. It was mainly confined to official competitions of some sort or another, whether it's sporting activities or drill competitions or whatever it is. I mean, the most painful thing was the junior drill competition, which was an inter-company competition for the junior term. And of course the senior term were determined that their company were going to win that, and that was fairly hard work, but it only happened obviously once in your junior term. But there were bursts of activity in various parts of the academy, but they were directed normally against outside, you know, it was at going out to the instructional staff or the establishment or the authorities in some way or another. Occasionally, I mean, there was one occasion where a senior under officer was strapped in his bed and transported somehow down into Camberley to, there was a cinema which had an arcade leading up to the entrance to the cinema, and he was transported in his bed in dead of night to that arcade and left there.
Was this because he was liked or disliked?
No, I think it was because he was disliked. But that happened. But there were both pre-war, the Royal Military College and the Royal Military Academy had been famous, I think, for the pranks and general hilarity that used to happen. And I don't know when it was, but sometime when I was there, and I think it had been done before, as I said, the main London Portsmouth Road ran just past the gate. We got up one morning and went on this breakfast roll call parade, and we were standing there staring into space, and we realised there was a lot of traffic moving around. And what somebody had done during the night was divert all the traffic from the main London road in through one gate at the Staff College gate, and was directing it all round the grounds of the academy, around all the buildings, great buses and lorries and cars and everything, bicycles, everything, and out at the Sandhurst gate at the bottom. And we all stood there, you see, watching all this going on. Obviously somebody knew who'd done it, but that was all right. There were one or two larks like that. Perhaps just to finish up with, I'd mentioned earlier these potties beside each bed in the building. In fact, this looked quite attractive. It was, I'm sure it was a summer ball. People involved with organising the ball collected all these potties, and they stuck a candle in each one and floated them on the lake. And so floating on the lake were, 900 potties, each with a candle inside. And it looked quite attractive. There was no bullying that I was aware of. I certainly wasn't involved. There were pranks and japes directed, as I say, outwards rather than inwards. And in the new building, there was a corridor went from one end to the other on the ground floor. And there were occasions when people on motorbikes would drive along that corridor, and they would be a fair target for anyone with a fire extinguisher or a bucket of water at each stairwell as they came to it along the corridor. And there must have been damage and breakages which we had to pay for. But obviously when you get 1,000 fairly fit, enthusiastic young people stuck together in what was a fairly monastic environment, it's part of life that they're going to have a go sometime.
If discipline was required, what form would it take?
Quite often it was extra drill parades or extra inspections. If it was something more serious, then it was being formally charged and marched in front of company commander. It could result in relegation, but if it was bad, you'd be sent down. You'd be returned to unit, RTU'd, which effectively meant you were out, finished. Because although we were private soldiers on a normal 5 and 7 engagement, there was a special clause in the engagement that if something went wrong at Sandhurst, for example, you could, without too much difficulty, get out of the army. You weren't committed to finishing your 5 years service. So it obviously was a slightly special engagement.
Moving through, starting as a junior, did you have examination hurdles or tests?
Yes, there were tests at the end of each term, your junior term, intermediate term, and senior term. A character grading, your sort of grading at the end of each term was made up in TMIC and character. Most people achieve some sort of balance, sort of 5 for this and 5 for that, or obviously, people who got more for character. It was out of 10 from memory for each thing. They were the people who became the cadet under officers or the cadet senior sergeants, that sort of thing. But it's interesting that not a lot of them achieved great fame and fortune in the army afterwards. Some achieved a certain amount of notoriety, but none of them of Intake 6. I'm trying to think whether Intake 6 actually achieved a major general. I don't think it did. Yes, it did. I'm sorry, it did. There was one, but I think he was unique.
Did you call his name?
Yeah, it was Mike Matthews, who, strangely enough, I'm now involved with, because he is secretary of the Council of Tavras in London, and so I see him from time to time. But I think he was the only major general we achieved in Great Intake 6.
Who was the camp commandant at your time?
Well, the commandant, the academy commandant, was General Stockwell, Sir Hugh Stockwell, who had been a great airborne man during the Second War. He was a good man, nice man, and everyone had a tremendous amount of respect for him. You didn't see a lot of him as a cadet. I mean, you'd see him walking around and so on, but you didn't have any great close contact with him as an ordinary cadet. I suspect that perhaps under officers may have done. But, obviously there were so many of us. There was no question of being invited to his house or anything like that. He lived on site. He lived in an army quarter on the premises. No, the man that had most direct impact on our existence was the adjutant, who was Charles Earle, Major Earle, who was a Grenadier Guardsman. And he took a bit of getting used to it. Well, he was all right. I mean, you know, there's no harm. And in fact, I came across him later on in life. In very different circumstances. But he really had the major impact. I mean, he really did worry most people. I can remember very early on in my junior term, you used to get around the campus, as it would be called now, on a bicycle. You were issued with a bicycle. I was riding from one classroom to another, the length of the academy, which involved cycling past the academy headquarters. And I had a pile of books on the handlebars, and I was just going past academy headquarters when the whole blooming lot came out of academy headquarters, the commandant, the adjutant, and everyone. And inevitably, I dropped the books fell off because I was trying, you had to ride to attention. In your bicycle, you did bicycle drill. Which was just like cavalry horse drill. You read to attention. In riding to attention, all my books fell off. I then fell off my bicycle, and there were a lot of them. They just burst out laughing, and that was that. But, that was the sort of impact they had. But I was comparatively junior cadet at the time. It was a very competitive existence, I think. But that was really just a continuation of school. You know, there was a competition to get into the company team or the academy team or the college team. If your company team or college team or the academy team were playing anything, whatever the activity was, you were expected to go and cheer and shout and so on. Which, again, you see, was part of your education because, as a young officer, you would be expected to do that in your unit. You would, you'd probably be playing with your platoon, as we all did eventually, but you'd certainly be expected to go and watch them, or watch the company team or the battalion team, and so it was all part of the training.
as part of your training, which I didn't ask, were you shown how to look after a platoon of men in the sense?
No. There was no military training of that sort, other than these, I think, slightly hilarious weeks in the Surrey Heathlands, where really, I mean, obviously you were amongst your peers and so on, but no, I mean, you had no experience or given any experience or training with a real platoon. That comes later when you join whatever it was you were joining, and that's where you started learning that, which I think to a lot of people now seems slightly strange, but it worked. I think basically because the 18 months we spent at Sandhurst, it later became a year, I think, and now goodness knows what it is. It's 6 months a start, and then they go away to university and come back and do another 6 months. It's all completely different. But I think the 18 months did produce, by and large, pretty competent leaders. And after all, that is really all that a soldier is looking for. He wants someone to make decisions. If it's hopefully the right decision, but even if it's not, doesn't matter. Someone's made a decision, whatever it may be. I think the whole 18 months was aimed at producing people like that. They had the rest of their military careers to learn the tricks of the trade. 20 years, 22 years, however long it was. You can learn a lot in 22 years. And so I think that was the basis of the training, to produce a fairly confident, fit, cheerful soul who could go off with 30 men and get on with it.
At the end of your time there, of course, did you have a final examination which you had to pass?
No, there was no question of passing or failing. There were final exams, obviously, but that merely contributed to your final grading. And that grading resulted in where you passed out in the order of merit. People didn't worry too much about that, because the main thing was to pass out. Whether you passed out in 150 or 93 really didn't matter an awful lot. And again, the people who passed out at the top, there was a person who passed out top academically got what did he get? A medal, I think. Medal of Honour. And the person who passed out top overall got a Sword of Honour on his passing out parade. But again, you see, I'm sure some of them did extremely well in the army later on, but none of them springs to mind now. I mean, I just can't think of the people who got the Sword of Honour in the 3 terms that I was there. None of them achieved any great military status in their future careers. So, you know, the passing out order, obviously, if you wanted certain corps and so on, demanded a certain standard, gunners, signals, engineers, the clever people, where you had to use your brain a bit, you had to pass out at a certain level, but cavalry, infantry, and so on, provided you passed out, the main thing was that before you passed out, you'd been accepted by the regiment you had selected. Perhaps that is worth mentioning, that at that time, they were, of course, very conscious of the fact that they were building a peacetime army. And so they had to be very careful that they didn't get too many people of one intake going into the same organization. Otherwise, as you progress through the pyramid, you'd end up with a whole lot of people at the top of the pile all expecting to be generals or commanding officers. I mean, again, you see, at that stage of the proceedings, I think quite genuinely the height of our ambition was to be a commanding officer of a battalion.
Selection, how did you come to select regiments? Were you asked to...
You were asked to put forward three choices. You had three choices. You may or may not have had a family claim. Your father may have been in the organization, or a brother or some relation. You may, if it was an infantry battalion, infantry regiment, you may have come from the county or the area that it was involved. Those really were, so far as the infantry was concerned, or in fact, as far as any of them were concerned, if you had a family claim or a geographical claim of some sort. I had no claim on any particular regiment, although my father was in the army. So I think I may have said right at the very beginning, he was a military musician and regiment to regiment. I had a cousin who had been in the KOILI during the war and had finished up in the parachute regiment and so on. But he, by that time in 1949, was involved with the territorial battalion of the KOI in Wakefield. And he and I got on very well together, although obviously he was older than I was. And he suggested, well, why don't you try for the KOILI? So I put my name down, and I was each regiment and corps and so on had a representative, an official representative at Sandhurst. I was called for by the light infantry representative, and it was, I knew before I got there, went to see him, that in fact there was no chance of getting into the KOILI because there were two people in my own intake who had a higher claim on the regiment than I did. However, off I went and had this interview, and he said, as I suspect he would, that Chris Wheeler and Doug somebody or other had a far higher claim than I did. But I'd seen the Durham Light Infantry. What about that? And I said, yeah, that's fine. To be quite blunt, obviously, I didn't know anything about it at that time. Never crossed my mind, because it didn't come from Durham. I had no knowledge of it. But that was how I came into the Durham Light Infantry. I then, having said yes please, the colonel of the regiment, old Jackie Churchill, who you and I know commanded 151 Brigade at Arras, he was colonel of the regiment and lived in Camberley. And so I was in due course summoned to meet him at his house in Camberley. At tea time, where we sat in the dining room and had boiled eggs and toast for tea, and we had a chat about this, that, the next thing. And he obviously thought that was all right. So I was then accepted by the regiment.
You passed the real test.
That was the main. I mean, you talk about exams and tests at Sandhurst. I mean, that really was the test as to whether you were accepted by the regiment. And I would say that was all right. But that was done fairly early on in, I think, may even have been your intermediate term. Certainly it was fairly early on in your senior term. And so you knew by that stage where you were going, which was fine. But there was no contact. I mean, there's no question, as they do now, I think, of going off to the battalion or the regiment, you know, to meet them or anything like that. But they were obviously being very careful as to how many people went into an organisation. I was the only one into the Durham Light Infantry from intake 6. The theory being that, and this possibly will come out slightly later on, but I mean, in theory, at that time, the Dharma Infantry had one regular battalion and three TA battalions. So unless I did something particularly stupid, there was a reasoning, one of them. And that was the way the whole thing was geared, which was fine and very sensible. In fact, we picked, as you, I'm sure you know, for a short spell we had two regular battalions, so that was five opportunities for command. That had gone by the time. And of course, by the time I got there, the Dharma Light Infantry had disappeared anyway. So that's another story. But that's how you chose your regiments. I mean, there were one or two very strange things. I mean, a great friend of mine who had been at Fort George with me, Johnny MacDonald, he came from Portree in the Isle of Skye and had enlisted. He was one of the very, very first people. He was one of the two who enlisted at the Reading recruiting office with me. So we'd been all the way through. Johnny had enlisted as a Cameron. He'd enlisted as a Cameron, that's right.